to hear some more about how and why a more recent generation of Jews became involved in public service. And we're going to hear about this from the children of parents who were actively involved in public service in a variety of roles in South Carolina. And as we'll see, that this is a multi-generational history as well, that where parents and their children have continued this tradition of public service as well. Each of our panelists will speak for 5 to 10 minutes describing their parents' involvement in public service, trying to explain this fascinating phenomenon, an unusual phenomenon, particularly marked phenomenon in South Carolina. And then I will perhaps, if we have time, pose some questions before opening it up to questions from all of you. So let me introduce each of our speakers in turn. We're going to begin with Billy Kaiserling. Billy was born in Beaufort, South Carolina. After receiving his undergraduate and graduate degrees in Boston, he spent a decade and a half on and around Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C., serving in a whole variety of roles as an aide for members of the U.S. Congress, coordinating an international human rights initiative, and working as a public affairs consultant. When Billy's mother, Harriet Kaiserling, left her seat in the South Carolina House of Representatives, which she had occupied for 16 years, Billy threw his hat into the ring and was elected to 2 terms in the House of Representatives from 1993 to 1996. In 2000, he was elected to the Beaufort City Council and served 1 term. In November of 2008, he was elected mayor of his hometown. Our second speaker will be Joel Lurie. Joel is a native of Columbia and a graduate of the University of South Carolina. He's the son of Susan Reiner and the late Senator Isidore Lurie. The Luries have deep roots in South Carolina. Joel's grandfather opened the first Lurie's department store in 1912, and the family has been involved in the civic and business life of the Midlands ever since. Following in the footsteps of his father, who served in the South Carolina legislature for 28 years, Joel was elected to the House of Representatives in 1998 and the state Senate in the year 2004. He balances his time between the family business and public service. He's involved, as all of our panelists are, with a variety of local community boards and commissions, and he's been recognized for his work in education, public safety, and healthcare. Our third speaker will be Ernie Marcus, who was born in 1986 and grew up in Utahville in South Carolina. On his mother's side, his family's roots in South Carolina date back to the 1840s. After graduating with undergraduate and graduate degrees in Washington, D.C., he spent the last 34 years in the field of real estate development in Washington, D.C., specializing in urban housing and mixed-use projects. He's been a member of a number of nonprofit boards, including community farmers markets, educational institutions, and currently the Jewish Historical Society of Greater Washington, and he lives in the District of Columbia. Our final speaker is Benedict Dick Rosen, who was born in Georgetown to Emma Levkoff of Camden and Sylvan Lewenthal Rosen, who served as mayor of Georgetown from 1948 until 1961, and as Georgetown County Attorney for more than 40 years. Dick attended Winyah High School and received his Bachelor of Science degree from MIT in Electrical Engineering in 1958. He retired as chairman of the board of directors for AVX Corporation in 2008, and previously he was president and chief executive officer responsible for AVX's worldwide operations and served as senior director of Kyocera Corporation Japan. Dick currently serves as director of several companies and sits on the board of several foundations, including those of Brook Green Gardens and the Bel Baruch Foundation. So let me start with our first presenter, with Billy, and we'll move down the line, each of them describing how their parents became involved in public service, and later we'll talk perhaps about how this in turn influenced them as well. So let me pass this to you to begin.
You'll see, I get to go first because I think I'm the old
one. No, I don't.
You were hiding behind Joel. I have to first congratulate Marty on his quick presentation. When he came to Beaufort to give the same presentation, it started at 8 o'clock on Friday night and concluded in time for Saturday morning service. But it's really a remarkable job of what he did. I don't know, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage because my mother recorded so much of her history in a book that many of you have read. So if I say something that doesn't match with the book, either she lied or I'm lying to you. But when I came back to Beaufort and ran for office, many people there thought that I was basically stepping into her shoes, and in fact I was. But my mother was not, as those many of you know her, a very public person. She was a displaced, liberal New York Jew living in a very small, bigoted southern town. She was a woman who wanted to bring culture to Beaufort, but couldn't bring it to the public schools because they were segregated. So she used the military bases to bring concerts and culture to Beaufort. She would never tell her children who she was going to vote for president. I'm thinking of Eisenhower Stevenson, because she didn't want us to get to tell our friends because we might get beaten up. But only after all four of us in 1974 had left home, she had to basically decide to do with her life what she wanted to do. And it turned out that while I think she had considered spending more time back in New York, she owned an apartment at the time, she decided, no, that she wanted to stay in Beaufort and to try to make Beaufort and South Carolina better so that all four of her children who had gone away to school would come back to a better place. She started in the county council, where my father, who had primarily served almost every African-American family before there were third-party payments, being paid with chickens and fish and shrimp and crabs and whatever, took her around to see his patients. And fortunately at that time, I wish we still had it, Beaufort County was at large elections, and there were enough people from New York living on Hilton Head that she ultimately became the top vote getter. But she did this very hesitantly, and my friend Bud Ferrillo, who any of you have been involved in politics or culture or equity kinds of issues would know, and I basically went to see her and said, you know, you got to go to Columbia. And she said, well, I can't go to Columbia because I don't know what to do there, and but you're wasting yourself on the county council, because you just are too far ahead of where these people are and the issues that you matter. So we basically signed her up to run for the state legislature and pushed her out there. And once she got elected, I remember she said, now what do I do? Fortunately, as she says in the book, Bud was then director of research when there was a very small research department in the House, and he aligned her with Bob Shaheen and Jean Toll and Parker, a handful of progressives. And they were, many of them, most of them were lawyers. And so Thursday afternoon, as Joel will know, they ran to their law offices to try to make a living. Well, she just came home with a stack of books and spent the whole weekend researching their issue for the next week. And Tuesday morning, when they raced over from their offices to go into session, she essentially briefed them on the subject, because she was going to get up at that podium with all those white Christian men out there. And they worked it out, and she really became sort of the brain trust, because she had the time and the discipline and the focus to know about issues. And that emulated when I counseled her. She said, you know, I go to the post office and all these people want to ask me questions, and I don't know everything we did, and as Joe will tell you, you don't know one-tenth of what happened, even when you're in the chamber attentive, because of the complexities and the ins and outs. So I said, well, we have a weekly newspaper, become an expert on one subject every week and write in the newspaper. And so she learned to, not only did she dominate the conversation in the post office when they'd say, Harriet, what's new? She would totally give them an education on nuclear energy in South Carolina. Or the foibles, the challenges of public education and the need for the Education Improvement Act. Or I can go through the litany of issues. But she ended up basically every week educating herself and then educating the public, which is how she sort of brought the public along with her, a public that wasn't ideologically behind her. But she made so much sense and she worked so hard. She survived for 16 years. Probably if she were alive, she could still be there. But I'll end by saying, more power to this man, because who the hell would ever want to be in the General Assembly?
I'm going to try this one second. Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
I'm the engineer.
There you go. It takes three people to show a state senator how to use a microphone. So. First of all, let me just again say good morning. And Billy, I enjoyed hearing so much about your mom, who's someone who, you know, I have had great respect and admiration for, and had the chance to work with her on some environmental issues after her service as I was starting my service. And she left quite a legacy on this state. And I know you like many of us, are very proud. Also, I'm just proud to be here this morning as we sit back and think a lot about my father, who many of you knew, Isidore Lurie, and all of his accomplishments in public service. I don't think there was something that he was more proud of than working with so many of you to create this organization and the Jewish Historical Society and the College of Jewish Studies, Marty, and I know that he's been from above seeing the continued success of this organization and of the college. I did want to introduce my driver with me this morning. Mom, would you stand up? Yeah. For those who don't know, my mother, she, like when I was in AZA, she wouldn't let me drive to Charleston by myself. So she insisted that, and actually we had a nice visit on the way down.
That's it.
And she made sure we had breakfast on the way down and all that kind of stuff. You know, for me, it was kind of interesting how my father got involved in public service. I don't think is any real secret. He grew up in a little town called St. George, South Carolina, in Dorchester County, and was very interested from the early days working for a guy by the name of J.D. Parla. And if you go down to St. George now, Parla Avenue is still the main drag. It's where our family started its first department store in the early 1900s, and where my father helped lead a family effort many years ago to renovate the old Arts Center, which is now called the Lurie Family Theater. But my father started at a very early age working for Senator J.D. Parla, was very interested in politics, both on a local level, on a statewide level, and on a national level, and just sort of took to it like a fish to water. When our family moved to Columbia, when he moved to Columbia, went to the University of South Carolina, he was the first, I think he may have been the first Jewish student body president, ran against his best friend. And won, and ultimately, you know, started his practice of law. He and my mother married in 1959. He ran for his first House seat in 1960, and this was back when you would have at-large districts, and there might be eight people running for five seats, and we still have that in some, like, county council or school district races and throughout the state, but in the legislature, it's all single-member district. So there were five people running. It may have been five or six. Excuse me. There were eight people running for five seats, and Dad came in six. First election he ever lost. Thank goodness it was the only election he ever lost. And that was 1960. Now, I'll tell you a funny story about that. My mother at the time was pregnant with my older brother, Lance, and she was all of 19? Something like that. 19 years old, and she was campaigning for my dad. You know, we kind of grew up, and we still do. I still do it, and I encourage all my friends that run for office, just door-to-door campaigning. I don't think there's any substitute for just shaking somebody's hand, telling them who you are and what you stand for, and I've you know, between my father and myself, have not gone tens of thousands of doors in my brief 49 years. But needless to say, my mother was going door-to-door campaigning for my dad, and she was pregnant with Lance, and she got bit by a dog. And we were all very alarmed about the, well, I wasn't alive, obviously, but, you know, all of her friends were very alarmed. And my brother, for those of you that don't know, is a tenacious lawyer in Atlanta, and occasionally he will foam at the mouth. And we are absolutely convinced it's from that dog bite. So anyway, he won his first election. Quick bit of history. I'm not superstitious, but in 1998, when I was running for my first race in the House, she again was going door to door in her neighborhood, Greg Park, and she again got bit by a dog. It was not the same dog, but thank God we won that election. So anyway, Dad was elected in the House. The moral of that story is stay away from dogs when you go door-to-door campaigning, or bring some mace. But Dad, you know, was elected to the House in 64, and then was elected to the Senate in 72. So he had a total of 28 years of service. And I think sort of what inspired him and what motivated him is what I think what motivates all of us who are Jewish. Part of our core values, which is to correct injustices in the world. And for those of you that followed his career, he was very progressive on the issues of civil rights before it was cool to be for civil rights. He was a real bridge between the black and white communities and the black and white churches and the business community and the black church. He was that common core bridge. He was just as comfortable going into an African-American church on a Sunday morning as he was our synagogue on a Friday night. And the relationships and the trust and the confidence that he built amongst people like I.D. Quincy Newman and I.S. Levy Johnson and a guy by the name of Reverend A.T. Butler and others really helped move our state forward during a very, very turbulent period during the late 60s. In 19 early 70s. I can tell you, Dad was the first to ever challenge the tradition in the House of Representatives. When the students would come to the gallery, they would introduce the white students from the white schools, but not the African-American students. And he stood up and just said, that cannot happen. I think he hired the first or appointed the first African-American page. And ultimately, he would pay the ultimate sacrifice in 1992 when he was trying to decide whether to run for re-election or not. He chose to step down, and I think he was very worn out and very tired, but he really couldn't decide. He felt it was time for his district, which had become about 50% African-American, to have another African-American voice in the Senate, and we got behind and supported, who is now a very close friend and colleague of mine, Senator Darrell Jackson. The issues that kind of, you know, in addition to just trying to correct injustices, I think people will always remember my dad for civil rights, for public education, for help with seniors, for just taking care of those that sometimes don't have the strongest voice before the General Assembly. And that sort of drove him to his, you know, that drove him from his core. And, you know, I think a lot of us, if we think deeply about our own faith, I think a lot of us is, why are Jews so active in cultural and social and nonprofit organizations? Why do Jews typically, and this is not a political statement, so please don't accept this, but why did most Jews overwhelmingly vote Democrat? Also, it's because typically the Democrats tend to always be the one to be a little bit more compassionate when it comes to public policy. And he passed that on to my brothers and I through our work, either my work in the General Assembly or my brother's work in their law firms. My mom and dad both did. And don't kid yourself. I always say behind every great political politician, behind every great man, there's a great wife and a surprise mother-in-law, okay? I can tell you the first time that I ever experienced anti-Semitism, interestingly enough, was working on one of his campaigns. And we grew up and you know, one thing about South Carolina, which does not have the proudest history on race relations, I think we've had a pretty proud and progressive history on interdenominational relations in South Carolina. We've had Jews that have played a very prominent role from the origin of this state in Charleston and in Columbia. And when I grew up, two of our four Richland County senators were Jewish, my father and also the late Hyman Rubin Jr. But I can remember going door to door, and I was in fifth grade. Let me think about that. That was his first election, 72, so this was 76. So I was in ninth grade. I was going door to door for my father. And what we used to do is my mom would take a pack of us and drop us, and we'd all hit separate blocks, and we'd meet at the end of the street, and we'd have campaign brochures. And I remember walking up, and there was an elderly gentleman sitting on the front porch, and I said, "How you doing? My name's Joel Lurie. I would appreciate you voting for my dad, Isidore Lurie, for re-election this November." And I'll never forget this. I can see him like he was sitting right in front of me. He said, "I wouldn't vote for that Jew if he was the last man on earth." And I was all of what? 14 years old in ninth grade, and I was just stunned. I mean, I was speechless. And I just said, "I'm sorry you feel that way." And I turned around and walked off. Of course, when I got home and told my father, he wanted to go find the guy and beat him over the head with his cane. But you know, we still, even today, I have the great honor and the great privilege of serving with people who served with my father. And I think the one way to describe him, and my friend Nikki Setzler, who's been in the Senate for 40 years, who's a dear friend of mine, the only Democrat that can get elected in Lexington County, Billy, if you can believe that. And he says, to this day, Isidore Lurie was the most compassionate person he ever met. And I think if I had to describe my father in one word, it would be that word, compassion. Again, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thanks for having me here so I can talk about my father, Harry Marcus, who was the mayor of Utahville for 23 years, about 50 miles northwest of here. Before I get started, I wanted to thank Dale, wherever she is, Dale and Marty and Rachel for inviting me to do this, and thanks to Ellen, my sister Ellen here, and Ronnie Cohen, and Blanche Cohen-Sistine, who also helped out greatly with photographs for the article that's in the newsletter. Because Dale said, "Is this all you got?" And so they really came through, and I really appreciate it. Before I talk politics, I wanted to talk about what's really a Utahville obsession, as my wife Madeline well knows. And it was an obsession shared by many of my relatives over the last 80 years or so. I call it the Utahville diaspora. They left from Utahville and ended up in New York City and Florida, but they all came back, and it was really quite something. The story starts at the turn of the century, when my grandfather, Morris Marcus, was a Lithuanian peddler, and he came to Utahville. A short time later, Harris and Sarah Cohen came to Utahville with their six children. Soon thereafter, Morris married Janie Cohen, and by 1909, though Harris, my great-grandfather, had died, leaving this family still in Utahville. And only 9 years later, my grandfather Morris died, leaving three more family members. And Katie Cohen soon married Abraham Karish. They had eight children. So pretty soon, what you ended up with was several female-dominated households in Utahville, all living in one or two houses. And I think this, probably because they were female-dominated households, they really became close, and this continued on to future generations, including my own children and certainly myself. In D.C., we still have Seders with three other members of this Cohen connection. We were all great-grandchildren of Harris and Sarah Cohen. We're all in Utahville. We're all having the Seder together. And this continued forth from this Utahville connection a long time ago. The closeness of this group of siblings, cousins, aunts, and uncles carried forward, like I said, for many generations. The children would spend their summers in the town, working in one of the stores, playing ball, playing cards, eating. A lot of eating. Typically, we would have fried chicken, collards, and arugula. We're very good pairings that we carried out. There was a huge fig tree in the back that seemed to grow taller with every telling of the story. And two of the kids that used to play around there were here, Blanche and Ronnie, sitting right here, who are not quite kids anymore, but not too far away. But to this day, there's really a deep longing from all of the cousins for the love and warmth of their time that was spent with family. And it's a time that's not likely to be repeated, as small-town Jewish life is really disappearing all of the South. And I think this closeness of family is what helped my dad, who was fatherless at 9, to really have the confidence to run for office. And not to mention the positive impact I think it had on me and my family, especially considering that my summer camp experience was spent, as Les knows, at the Citadel and at the Royal Ambassadors for Christ summer camp. Because all my friends were going, and they said, "You want to go?" And so I went. And I spent a lot of Sunday school mornings in Bible class, also at the local Baptist school. So family was very important. As I mentioned a lot more in detail in the newsletter, Dad spent most of his life in Utahville. He spent a couple of pre-bar mitzvah years in Charleston, getting ready for his bar mitzvah. He spent a year at Carolina before he quit to help his mother in the store, because his brother Jaime, who's later a doctor in Orangeburg for 50 years, was going to medical school. During the Depression, he came up again with the help of the family to the Bronx. There were no jobs in the town, so he worked for the Western Union, and this was an ongoing underground railroad of Southern Jews going up to New York, of which he was one. After he spent 4 years during World War II in the Pacific Theater. Actually, just before this, he spent time in the town council as a secretary and treasurer of the council. And when he came back, they said he should run for mayor. And he decided to do that. He also married Ellen and my mother in 1948. And he had quite a few accomplishments in his 23 years as mayor. Some of them are listed in the newsletter. One of the most important, I think, was the 75,000-gallon water tank and 6 miles of water lines that were put throughout the town. There was no public water in the town. They later called it Harry's Monument, and it's still there. He also extended the boundaries of the town. Many of the town streets were not paved. There were no sidewalks downtown. There was no dial telephone service. I actually read some documents about the council's efforts to get United Telephone into the town in the early 1960s. There was a Trailways bus service established to the town. There was a new post office, a new health clinic. Even a rescue squad was started along with the Swamp Fox Boat Club, which had volunteers there. They didn't have a regular garbage collection up to that point, which they started. He arranged for a deputy sheriff to live in the town to provide critical protection. He welcomed 25,000 campers for the National Camporee there at Rocks Pond Campground, which some of you might know is close by. At his retirement, a local paper said, "Few have ex-Mayor Marcus's drive and tenacity. Under his guidance, the town and the whole township were constantly being bettered by his optimism, farsightedness, and dauntless efforts in building up and advertising the area." But I did want to give you a sense of some work that they did, some important work, by telling you of some of the ordinances that were passed in the early 1950s under his leadership. These reflect the mores of the Bible Belt and the peculiarities of the time. There's the important $20 fine imposed if you left the door open to your outhouse. And I'm sure all the people in town really appreciate it. And then there was the law, again $20, for visiting a house of ill repute, which is the same fine. But they really threw the book at you if you played the viola on Sundays. You could spend 30 days in jail and a $100 fine. Wow. So I'm guessing that one of the councilmen lived next door to a musician. Anyway, Adam had asked that I also mention how the experience of Dad being the mayor might have impacted my life. I think in a small town, you know, if something's going wrong, you can't wait on somebody else to take care of it. And when you do take action, you actually see the results of the action on a micro level. And when I look at Dad's accomplishments, I really see that he was impacting education, health, infrastructure, social issues. You might even call it a holistic approach, although no one would say that back then. And in my work today as a real estate developer in D.C., I work in a lot of diverse parts of the district, and a lot of my projects include nonprofit groups which deal in education, health, job training, really a full range of services to the community. And I always felt like a successful real estate project required a healthy community, particularly in the areas that I tend to work, which are quite diverse, let's say. And in my community activities with schools and farmers markets, affordable housing, I think, like my father, I've tried to balance business and social good. So for me, and I think my father, growing up in Utahville was a gift. I think I can say the same for my siblings. And the town and its people, the memories are an integral part of who I am today. And I know my father was frustrated at some extent about living far from a Jewish community. And I think he sometimes wished for a different life for our family, not being as connected to Jewish life. But I think his multiple connections to the community, the town he led, the African-American families that he knew, who shopped in his store, his own extended family, were really the pillars of his life. So, thanks.
Thank you, and thank you for inviting myself, representing my family, to be here today. I've disadvantaged some of you folks. I left home before Dad did a lot of things that he did later, because I'm much older than any of you, despite what you think. But remembering Dad growing up, actually, Dad became mayor in 1948. I think I must have been about 12, and I left for college before he was still, in fact, I finished college before he, when he was still mayor. But Dad was really interested in the community he grew up in. He grew up in Georgetown. I think he was born there. I'm not really sure. Nobody knows. But as near as I can tell, he was. I know his mother grew up there. His mother and her sister imported guys from New York to marry him. This was back in the... that's all I can figure, because there weren't any Jewish guys, so they got a couple of guys from New York, and they formed a new store in Georgetown many, many years ago. And Dad went to law school and found Mom in Columbia, and before he left, brought me with him. I didn't go to Carolina. See, I was born there. But Dad was really interested in the community he lived in. His activities were more on the local level as far as the mayor's part, but he was also very active. I'll talk about that in a minute. But he was really active in the Jewish community, which I truly don't understand, because he didn't grow up with a strong Jewish background. I mean, it was Jewish, but it was the religious part of it was almost non-existent. But he spent many years, and I went all over the state with him. My brother did. I have one younger brother, campaigning for the UJA and for B'nai B'rith, and it wasn't home. So we went with him so we could be with him. But I didn't know there was a Clemson or a Buford, to be honest with you, until we went to the UJA meetings and the various Jewish seminars. And he actually went up in North Carolina as well. But he was elected mayor pro tem in 1948, and his good friend of his died. His name was Miller. I don't remember his first name. And Dad became mayor and served for many years after that. But he was really committed to the community we lived in. He was, it's interesting, as years go by and people tell you who knew him, or their parents knew him or whatever. I've met a guy named Johnny Joseph, he's a dentist in Georgetown, yesterday, by coincidence, and he said, Dad would say, we really need to do this, but we better go ask Sylvan first. They wouldn't do anything in the community, I'd say everybody, but many people just looked at him as the leader of the community, and what should we do other than just being mayor? He was much more than that. And that was not, as some of you suggested, that was not just the white community. we have a number of people that we know that are black, and it was the same thing. He was there, not just their lawyer, but their advisor and the confidant in the building of the city. While he was mayor, they expanded the city. I think they actually got electricity. They had electricity, but that generator always broke down. Well, he worked a deal with somebody, and he got them to bring Santee Cooper to bring power into the town. And I think they actually brought some, they had water, but it wasn't very good. But he very much was a builder of the infrastructure. One of the things I remember that was indicative of his commitment, and it wasn't a lot of money, but there was a guy named Gabriel Heater, who was, I think it was a Mutual Broadcasting something. We didn't have television, it's long before you. But he selected Dad in the city council his man of the year because they forfeited whatever income it was they had because the city needed it, and they did this for a period of time. But again, he really wanted the city to succeed. It was where he grew up. He was very committed to it, and very, very committed to the Jewish community. It's really hard for me to understand the connection, even today. It was because he didn't grow up in that environment. We built the temple in Georgetown. It was between mine and my brother's bar mitzvah. I'm told I was the first person to be bar mitzvah, but Georgetown got a cemetery that's 250 years old. I don't know what all the Jewish kids did, but apparently nobody was bar mitzvah. Dad's dying wish was make sure the temple survived, because there were very many people. Some of you know Elizabeth Moses. She came down and really put it back together, and it's working very well now. But he said, make sure they don't do anything with the temple, and they wanted to sell it. And I told him I'd buy it. He couldn't sell it. But it's done well. But that was the Jewish part of his commitment, and Mom was very much a part of that as well. As you say, you talk about fathers, but without mothers, we wouldn't have fathers either, and they wouldn't have been very successful as well. They're very important. But Dad's commitment was to the community. In fact, I resented it. Now, I have to tell you the truth for everybody here. I really wanted a dad. I didn't want to be the mayor and the UJA. I didn't want anything to do with that. It took me a long time to accept that that was okay, because that's what Dad did. And I'm sure many of you who have had that same experience, your father did a lot of things that took the time away from you, and is a very selfish young man, which unfortunately some of us are. I didn't like that. When he gave that money away, I wanted to buy me a car. And he explained what was important. And I think the day I recognized that, it took me a long time. But a very giving family, and a mom and dad. And I make one comment, and I'm not going to talk anymore. It's got to do with his investment in Israel. I once had I don't even remember the reason, but Mr. Zucker and I had a discussion at one of these things in Charleston about investing in Israel, which we did. And actually, I was part of the first venture capital group in Israel. And they're very ingenious. They work very hard. And they're the stubbornest people, most difficult people in the world to work with. So if you want to do that, know what you're getting into. I threatened to throw a guy off the top of a hotel. I was so mad at him. He worked for me. But I'll conclude there. But thank you for letting me share.
Thanks to all of our panelists for really wonderfully insightful and fascinating descriptions. I'm going to pose some questions to the panel, and you each are welcome to respond or choose not to respond, and then we'll open it up to questions from the floor. The first question is an obvious question, but did your parents' Jewishness play any part in their political careers? And was it an impediment in any way? Were there any advantages to being Jewish and seeking office? Did it ever become an issue in their political campaigns as well?
I would just say that my father was a veteran. He was a local boy, and his family had been there for 80 years, a long time. So I think running for office, you really had a lot of advantages. I also feel like because of his position as a merchant, primarily oriented to African American customers, and also serving white customers and having relationships there. He really had feet in both camps, and even though he was the other, so to speak, maybe he was the best person to connect the two sides, and I think it made him effective.
A year and a half ago, when my mother passed away, I was talking to Marty, and I said she really wasn't very Jewish, and he said she was very Jewish, but she was a prophetic Jew. And I think, in a sense, I've heard that in all of these stories, in that we were not observant Jews. When it was a question of playing football on Friday night or going to synagogue, we were allowed to play football. When it was a question of any number of things. But if I go back and look at my family, I think of my grandfather, who came here and became a farmer, who helped started and probably played a big role in creating the synagogue, yet he never went. Who died of a massive heart attack while giving a speech at a national UGA convention in New York, but rarely went to synagogue. So the prophetic Jew, as Marty explained to me, was very helpful to me, make that distinction that I can still be Jewish. I don't go to synagogue. But there's something in my culture, my genes, my makeup that makes me feel, that gives me the inspiration to do what is right for the bigger community. And as I heard all of these stories, I certainly know, I won't speak to Isidore's, whether or not he was an observant Jew, but I will say that one of the slight overlap when he was there and I was there, clearly he was every bit the social justice pioneer, which I think comes very, very much from the Jewish experience. So the prophetic means you don't have to go to synagogue. You just do the right thing.
Unfortunately, I happen to be talking when you asked the question, but I think I understand it is, what role did Judaism play? Thank you. What role did...
Was the Jewishness ever an advantage, an impediment in their political careers?
Sure, yeah. I think, interestingly enough, I don't know, as far as my father is concerned, other than that one episode that I described earlier, I don't know that I ever heard his faith become an issue raising a campaign. Ironically, or somewhat surprisingly, it did become an issue once or twice in my campaigns. But I will tell you this, being Jewish for my father, who was, St. George, they used to say there was 1.5 Jewish families in St. George. But all the kids would either come to Columbia or Florida or Charleston to get bar mitzvahed. He was very proud of his faith, and he incorporated that into everything he did. And I think just listening to the other panelists this morning, I'm not surprised, but still very always appreciative of the common thread that runs amongst all of our fathers and probably in mom and all of us in this room. And that is, to always be a spokesman for justice and always try to help those that are less fortunate. I'll tell you an interesting story about my dad. And every year in Columbia at Hanukkah, and certainly we would invite you all to come, we have an annual menorah lighting at the State House. And Rabbi Hesh Epstein, who, helped bring Chabad to Columbia, came to see me shortly after my father's death. And he said, "Joel, we'd like to do a menorah lighting at the State House. And what do you think about that?" And I said, let me just kind of ponder on it a day or two. On one hand, I love the idea. On the other hand, I'm very defensive on separation of church and state issues. And I talked to some friends of mine in the Christian community who work on separation of church and state, and we decided it was most appropriate, particularly outside, and it was not a state-sanctioned ceremony. It's a ceremony we have at the State House, and it has come to be a very nice ceremony. God always looks after us. It can be raining the whole day, but it has never rained on that one event. Okay. But what's always nice for me is to see the menorah, which, by the way, we named in my dad's memory. We always call it the Isidore Lurie Menorah Lighting Ceremony. To see the menorah in this eye and to see the Christmas tree up, I think represents what so many of us think is great about South Carolina and what's great about America. But I always tell the story, and I think it gets back to maybe your question. When Rabbi Epstein came to see him 20-something years ago when he was still serving in the Senate, and he said, "Senator Lurie, I want to have a public menorah lighting ceremony." And at that time, he said, "What about having it at the old Columbia Mall?" And Rabbi Epstein was new to Columbia, and he just wasn't sure about having a big public showing of Judaism in the Deep South. And so he said, kind of like people would go see your dad, he'd say, "Well, let's go talk to Senator Lurie and see what he said about it, and what do you think?" And my father embraced it because he felt like putting it out there, explaining it, the more people understand about our faith, the less people will be prejudiced, and the more people will understand how all of our faiths are so closely tied together. So I think it drove everything he did, and I think it drove all of his work and all of his issues, as I mentioned in my earlier comments, sort of just brought back to his core values about what he thought was right and wrong and where he thought he could make a difference.
I think everything to be said has been said. It probably applies to all of us. Those of you who grew up in New York and you have perceptions of prejudices, whatever. We didn't have any because we didn't have any other Jews. So I didn't have any Jewish friends unless it was my brother. Because there weren't any other people. It was, the next one's 4 or 5 years younger. But it was interesting in the community. In Georgetown, the Jews were very important. First of all, I had all the clothing stores. If you wanted to buy anything, it was Hanukkah, Yom Kippur or something, you couldn't because everything was closed. But the community, that was part of the community. It wasn't just the Jewish people. And I was never experienced any kind of anti-Semitism whatsoever. And remembering talking to Dad and Mom, nobody had any experiences. Actually, an article in the last bulletin from my cousin, Laz Snyder, and he comments on that in there. So I don't know that his work ethic, his commitment to people certainly was Jewish. But as far as anything, I don't think it had any effect whatsoever except on his personal life and how he led it and his commitment. It certainly didn't have any negative effects anywhere to any of us. I think if you grow up in New York, you can have a ghetto. The ghetto would be just me. I mean, you couldn't have a ghetto. There wasn't one. My wife grew up in Massachusetts, and she had 6 or 8 Jewish friends, and they were her friends. Well, if I had all the Jewish friends, I wouldn't have any friends, and I did have a couple. So it was a whole different environment that we grew up in. All of us, I think.
Sure. Absolutely.
So, it's a question which might not apply in particular cases, but did your parents ever encounter any pressure from the Jewish community because of their political activism and because of their prominence? Was there any occasions which they were indirectly or directly told that their activity was putting others in difficult positions?
Not at all.
No. They sometimes told her she was too liberal.
So that wasn't Jewish. That was just too liberal. That was a influence of his son.
it was just in jest. I said some may have told her she was a little bit too liberal.
Right.
getting a little too far out front.
So we've talked a little bit about, or suggested a little bit about the role of a spouse. Can you each speak about this some more about the role of a husband and wife in supporting the political activity, political engagement of a husband or wife? Did your parents enjoy this role, the non-political parent enjoy being a politician's, a mayor's wife, a representative's wife? Or was this something, again, which they had not actively sought the limelight, something that they found an imposition?
My mother was a joiner, so she belonged to the garden club for about 40-plus years. She had bridge club every week, every other week, for 40 years. So I think she was much better at getting the votes out than my father was. So I'm sure never delivered one political speech in his life. I actually asked him once, was he a Democrat or Republican? He had this quizzical look, and he said, I don't remember. It wasn't a very political activity, but I think that she was more natural at speaking to people than he was. Although he belonged, like I think a lot of Jews in the state, to the American Legion, the Lions, the Shriners, the Masons, everything.
I think I said earlier that while my friend Bud and I were her advisors, my father was my mother's vote getter. And that basically they literally went knocked on the doors of his patients, who were basically the most downtrodden people in northern Beaufort County. And then she found a few friends from New York. My father was, not a stay-at-home dad by any means. He was one of only five doctors, and there were many nights when it was easier for him, more convenient for him, to spend the night at the hospital, because on top of everything else he did about 150 obstetrics cases a year, 6 days in the office, and on and on and on. But I have to say that when my mother made this decision, he was so incredibly behind her that he actually started taking time to drive her. She was, I wish I could remember the story, but those who knew my father knew he sometimes told a few jokes, and sometimes his jokes were off color. And those were the more fun for him and the most embarrassing for my mother. But he drove mother up to Somerville, I think it was Somerville, to a League of Women Voters event. No, it was a hearing on pro-choice, pro-life, whatever you want to call it. I don't like that distinction, because we're all pro-life. It's just a question of defining about a woman and a family decision rather than a politician's decision. But someone stood up and insulted her. I think it was someone in Berkeley County, maybe, not in Georgetown. And he got up, just in the audience, and just talked this man down. But I found that actually, in their case, her having this life of her own that was so different from his, brought them together in a way that they maybe had not been. Remember, she was this very intellectual, engaged New Yorker who found herself stuck in Beaufort, South Carolina, without a life. As soon as she created a life, their lives balanced. And I was very, very surprised to see how supportive he, essentially an apolitical person, became.
Well, of course, because she's in the room today. But even if she wasn't, I know that Arlene Polinsky right here would go back and tell her whatever I said. I don't think you could have had a better, and I've said this, but anybody that knows my family will tell you, you could not have had a better political spouse or a better political mother than my mom. And I mean that. I mean, my mom is I always joke with people that say, well, I'm thinking about running against you. I say, well, you might could beat me, but you'll never beat my mom. We take my mother, and we put her I'm a Democrat, for those of you who don't know, we put her at the most Republican precinct in my district. And she stands there from the time the polls open at 7 a.m. to the time the polls close at 7 p.m., maybe an hour for lunch, maybe an hour to rest. and we always win the precinct, okay? I just stay the hell away, okay? But in all honesty, to answer your question, she truly was my father's political partner. I mean, people knew her as much as they knew him, and she would frequently go to functions and things with him. She'd go to conferences, and she was very much a part of his political life, and unquestionably his political success. And the fact that she too was born and raised Jewish, I think, just made them the perfect partnership. And she felt just as strong about our family's Judaism as he did. In fact, I'll tell you one quick story. When Dick Riley was governor, my uncle David Reiner was head of Hillel at Carolina, and I just told you about the menorah lighting ceremony. Hillel was having a menorah lighting ceremony. You almost think all we do in Columbia is have menorah lighting ceremonies. But anyway, Hillel was having a menorah lighting ceremony, and my Uncle David, who was president of Hillel, had arranged for Dick Riley to come light the first candle. And it was going to be in the Russell House at the university campus. And so I come home on a Monday afternoon. I'm like a sophomore in high school. And I say, "Hey, Mom, what's going on?" She says, "Well, you know, tonight we've got that menorah lighting ceremony, and, you know, your dad's going to be speaking, and Uncle David has arranged for Governor Riley to come, and I hope you'll come." I said, "Well, you know, Mom, it's Monday night, and at that time I used to always like to go to the Jewish Community Center and play basketball with all the young business people in the community, Gerald Sonnenschein and others." And she said, "Well, you know, this is really special, and special to your dad, and it's special to your Uncle David. He's really worked hard on this. I really hope you'll go." I said, "Well, I really don't want to. I'm going to go play basketball." I said, "I tell you what I want you to do. I want you to go downstairs and do your homework, and you come tell me about 6 o'clock. You think about the right thing to do." So I said, "Sure." So I went downstairs and did my homework, and about 6 o'clock, I come upstairs with my sweatsuit on and my high tops and my basketball. And she says, "Well, what are you doing?" She said, "You said I could make the decision, and I'm going to play basketball." And she says, "I gave you the choice. Now get your butt downstairs and put your coat on." And that is a true story. So. But truly, in all seriousness, I think anyone that knew of my father's success would know that he would have never won his first election and would never been able to accomplish the things that he did without my mother. They truly were a great partnership, and I'm very proud to have her as my counselor, as she will call me every morning with the typical Jewish mother, "I'm not trying to tell you what to do, but..."
And my wife still does that for our kids, but they don't live as close by. That doesn't make any difference. I think, Mom, as far as the politics of election and what have you, I don't think in Georgetown Dad was so popular, it didn't matter. He could have won. I mean, Mom was a part of it, but it wasn't so much a political asset, but she was very much a part of the community. She was very active in the Red Cross. They now named the Red Cross Volunteer of the Year for Mom. She's got her own little building. And she was a very much a part of the community. All the political things Dad attended, she went with them. With a quick story about Mom's political acumen. They dedicated a stamp to Lafayette when I must have been 16 or 17 years old, something like that. And we had the French ambassador and a whole entourage over at our house one really hot afternoon. It was in July. This is after I almost ran over the ambassador, but he's sitting there and he's really tired. She said, come on back in the kitchen, I'll get you a beer. And that's how she made peace with the French. Meet her again. I don't think anybody can be successful really almost at anything without the support of their spouse. And I've been reasonably successful in it because of that frizzy looking blonde back there.
So we have some time for questions from the floor, if anyone wants to ask our panelists any questions.
I've been given in the past 2 perceptions of anti-Semitism, South Carolina style, coming here in 1968. One perception was that there are people who are anti-Semitic, but they're too polite to express that to you. And as a result, it's larger than your city. And the other is that, yes, there is anti-Semitism, and it is expressed by certain other groups that have a political interest in doing that. But let me not mix it up. That in reality, though, there's still a great deal of acceptance of Jews, because people here believe very much in their religion and have a great interest in the fact that you have an interest in your religion, and that in that sense they're friendly. So fundamentally, which is it, or is it 50-50?
Oh, I'm game.
Okay.
I think you have to quantify it. Charleston is probably one thing. Georgetown was certainly something else. People were, when I grew up, and even today, they probably don't even know what a Jew is. There weren't enough to matter, and those that did matter, they were very close to, and it was very much a part of the community. I don't know that would necessarily be true in Charleston. I don't think it would necessarily be true if you had large groups of Jewish people who tended to some extent, congregate among themselves. And I think it creates some barriers, a ghetto or whatever. But I don't think politeness, as you suggest, all of us Southerners are pretty proud of that. I don't think that would have been a factor at all. I don't know how anybody else feels, but I just don't think it was a factor. If you go to Greenville and to the Bible Belt, I don't know what it's like there, because I've never been there. Maybe it is different. In fact, there was somebody ran for office there a few years ago, and it was a big issue. So, I mean, it's not... South Carolina is not one place. And so I think you have to, I don't know where, but I think you have to differentiate or segregate the areas.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, as I mentioned to you earlier, I don't know. I think when my dad was campaigning, I can remember as a child people calling the house, but the inflammatory remarks they were making about him were not because of his faith. They were more because of his support for civil rights. And they called him some very ugly things. And I can remember him slamming down the phone and saying, "I will not be intimidated." And, I think for the most part, as I mentioned earlier, we lived in a time for a while in Richland County where two of our four senators were Jewish. In my own races, I've experienced once or twice. I can remember in one campaign I was running against, I had a very, very well-financed opponent in a general election who was a very, you would identify him what we would still call maybe the Christian conservative coalition, or however you might describe it. And he would go into people's homes and say, "You know, Joel's a great guy, blah, 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 but you know, he's not one of us. He doesn't believe in Jesus." And for the most part, I mean, we won, so I guess it was fairly soundly rejected. But I agree with you. I think it just depends on where it is. I don't think there is just one South Carolina regard of that. I think overall today, I would like to think, for the most part, is a very tolerant state from a religious standpoint.
Growing up in Beaufort, growing up in Columbia is a different thing. In Beaufort, with five general practitioners, all the doctors loved the fact that my father was Jewish, because he took the duty on Christmas and Easter. But in a political context, it never came out with the word Jew, whether liberal, baby killer, anti-developer, were code words or something. I don't think so. But I think, you know, we were in the small towns. We were very in our early days. The community was dependent upon us because we provided certain services in these small towns, and we were too few to be a threat. My paternal grandfather, who I didn't mention was a farmer, was on Beaufort City Council and was mayor pro tem as well. He was, according to stories, not allowed to belong to the Rotary Club or the Country Club. Insisted that when my father came back from the war with his bride, insisted that they do both, which my mother really wasn't interested in hanging out with those people, but and they did, and that was sort of the end of it. So, but it's going to be the size of the community and the individuals, I believe, more than a universal. I mean, to hear the story of his grandfather, how could they have been anti-Semitic?
I'll just say briefly that I think my father had the advantage of being white, which I think in a town that was probably a township that was probably 75% African American, I think that really blocked most anti-Semitism that would come his way. I mean, obviously there was a substantial impact, but it wasn't stated. You know, we weren't going to the Sunday socials, which is a huge part of small town life in South Carolina, the church. So we just, you know, we weren't invited to this. We didn't want to go to this. So it certainly had an impact, but it was very, very seldom verbal.
Let me say one more thing about that, because, you know, there's another kind of anti-Semitism, and it's the blacks. Who all of a sudden lost faith in their friends or didn't realize who their friends were or who had been. And I say this from virtue of my uncle and his work in the labor movement, the housing movement, the civil rights movement. But the alienation in cities and the anti-Semitism that you might see in cities is something that has never divided, to my memory, in South Carolina, the partnership between the minorities of black and white or black and religious.
I think we have time for just one more question at the back of there.
I grew up in New York, and you know, I kind of felt when I moved down here that it really opened my mind a lot to Judaism. And I'll tell you the reason why. I think in New York, where there's just so many Jewish people living there, and you know so many Jewish people, you tend to take for granted. And I wonder, what my question to you is, living in a small town where there's just a few Jewish families, if any, how did that come into play as far as taking it, whether you took Judaism more seriously in your home, or whether it was something that, you know, you felt was taken for granted? Does that make any sense?
Just the end, I wasn't real clear right at the end. Your question.
I mean, in growing up in a small town as one of just a few Jewish families, how did you feel about your Judaism in that regard, and how did it impact as far as your family life, and how did it impact maybe how you practiced your Judaism in later life and with your family as Jews in your life?
It's a good question. I think for the most part, you know, we had a Christmas tree. You know, I think there was at some degree there was an effort to blend in because we were the only Jewish family. It wasn't like we can go over to Aaron's house and visit his Hanukkah bush. there was no one else. But at a certain point, I think I was 12. I said, why do we have a Christmas tree? So I think it wasn't something I could take for granted. And I think it led me over time to approach Judaism more closely than maybe I would have otherwise. And then when I went to Washington and my wife grew up, let's say, conservadox, they said, and I had a lot of catching up to do, and you know, I'm very proud actually that my kids are, you know, really have a Jewish life, and it's very important to me. But you know, it's tough being a country Jew too, because I went to Beth Elohim in Charleston, and coming in you know, I was not welcomed totally by the Jews from Charleston, because we were country Jews, and that was really different. So it was another level of prejudice.
Your introduction about being from Jewish or being from New York reminded, I was married unsuccessfully for a very short period of time. But the woman I married decided she wanted to convert, and she worked very, very hard, and she did convert to Judaism. And we were in New York once, and there was a busload of Hasidim going somewhere, but it was a big yellow school bus. And she said, "Boy, Billy, look at the Jews." And here we are, you know, in Manhattan. I said, "Which ones?" I said, "Maggie, they're all Jewish. We're in New York." But I don't, you know, being Jewish, we didn't, because we had a small community, and because there were very few in our age group, and because we didn't have a gathering place other than at services, or we did have a religious school, and most of us were bar mitzvah notwithstanding, part-time transient rabbis. I was extraordinarily fortunate in that there was a young Navy chaplain at Parris Island who got me through. But, you know, there weren't any, I was the only Jew in the Hot Rod Club. And I was really the only Jew who played high school football. And so we were so small and we had so many differences that we didn't come together very often, other than around activities at the synagogue. We all were sort of assimilated in the community more around our interests rather than our culture and our religion.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for those of you that are not from South Carolina, since I'm from Columbia, I don't necessarily see myself from a small town. Being from New York, I'm sure you might view it differently. But I think it just started at home. I mean, you know, our parents sort of instilled in us, as my wife and I have instilled in our children, the importance of our faith. And we were very much able to integrate our BBYO activities and our Hebrew school activities, and it really never kept us out of the broader social scene in middle school and high school. Probably the biggest challenge we had was the Columbia Jewish Community Center always had a very competitive basketball team, but as you can imagine, we never had much height. We had great shooters, but not much height. So we dealt with that my senior year in high school. One of my best friends was an all-state football player by the name of Mike Kirk. 6'5", 235 pounds, went on to play college football. We changed his name to Kirkstein, gave him an honorary membership to the Jewish Center, and we won the city championship.
We didn't have any of those things at Georgetown. How did it affect my life? I guess everybody has this own experience, and if you have a different one, please don't think it as meaning anything wrong. But I grew up, I didn't have a Jewish girlfriend. I didn't know a Jewish girl, except a cousin who wasn't very attractive. But I went to Boston, and I found Brenda. She found me. However it worked out, she's Jewish. My brother found a Jewish girl. We have three kids, all of whom married Jewish people. And everybody's been bar mitzvah or bat mitzvah. So we did okay.
Wonderful.
So, thank you again to all our panelists. This is a wonderful panel. And I'm sure they'll be happy to just hang around and get questions for them directly afterwards to come speak to them. Thank you.